This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The automotive industry is unveiling its new cars in Detroit at the North American International Auto Show, perhaps the most important auto show in the world. My guest Paul Eisenstein says that he's seeing more changes in design and technology than he's ever seen in the 23 years he's covered the industry. Eisenstein is the publisher and editorial director of thecarconnection.com. He used to report from Detroit for NPR and is now a commentator on NPR's Morning Edition. He's past president of the Automotive Press Association. Eisenstein has been to this year's Detroit and Los Angeles car shows. I asked him to describe some of the biggest changes in the new cars.
For one thing, we're seeing an emphasis on product again. For the last 6 or 7 years, this has been a business that tried to go back to smoke and mirrors. They talked about brand, but what that was largely about marketing. You know, you told people this car was better, but you didn't necessarily make a better car. Well, suddenly people are saying product, and they mean it. And what you're seeing are all sorts of vehicles tailored to specific niches, really fine-tuning products to what specific groups of customers want, and giving them all sorts of innovations. What's even more interesting is there's a push to drop the price on those cars. Prices have been going down every year for the last 5 years, something unheard of in the auto industry. It's more like consumer electronics.
Well, let's look at some of the new cars. What's happening with the SUV? The SUV has fallen into disfavor because it's a gas guzzler and also because of safety problems. So what's happening with the SUV and what are the new alternatives?
Well, I'm going to take exception with you about it falling into disfavor. It's fallen into a little bit of disrespect in certain groups. Mm. It is definitely the vehicle you love to hate if you're into environmentalism or safety because it is a gas guzzler and it does have, in total, a bit of a safety problem. You know, you have these big excursions and expeditions. Some of them weigh 4 tons or more. And when they ram a small car, you do have a problem. On the other side, people who are in the big SUV really like it because they feel safe and they feel like they can get through anything. I live in Detroit. You get a lot of snow here, and people love the fact that they sit high, they can look over the big snow piles in the worst of the winter, and that they can get through just about anything. But, on the other hand, what may kill the SUV, if it ever does die, is the fact that everybody's driving them. It has become the hottest thing on the road. Interestingly enough, this last year, for the first time in U.S. history, light trucks, which include vans, minivans, sport utility vehicles, and pickups, outsold all passenger cars combined.
Wow.
That's a major transformation in the industry.
You've written about the new station wagons that are being marketed now and how they're a compromise for people who don't want a minivan or an SUV.
Yeah, I probably didn't answer your previous question fully, so I'm glad you followed up on that because there is a transformation. The SUV that originally hit the market was really not meant for the average driver. It was a rough and rugged vehicle you took into the back roads, you took to a work site. Over the last decade, we've seen the evolution of the car-like SUV. You know, they ride a little bit better. They're easier to drive. They have all sorts of luxury features inside. I mean, some of these look like you're inside of a Mercedes or Cadillac. But the traditional SUV is still not as easy to drive as that luxury sedan. There's a new generation of what you call crossover vehicles coming. These are vehicles that may have passenger car frames and SUV bodies so that they're more fun to drive. They get better gas mileage. And what's interesting is the next wave of evolution is starting to return to something that the SUV helped kill off, which is the old station wagon, the Leave It to Beaver mobile. It was everywhere 40 years ago. I owned one of my first cars. My family always had station wagons. They vanished. They were as dead as dinosaurs. And yet, if you go to L.A., or to the Detroit Auto Show, and most of the shows you're going to have around the country in the coming months, you're going to see vehicles that most people are going to look at and say, that's a station wagon. The only difference is they won't call them station wagons. Actually, the other difference is they're going to be a lot more functional and fun to drive than the ones that we remember from the days when Leave It to Beaver was a hit show.
Describe what's most interesting about the new station wagons.
Well, for one thing, they don't have wood cladding. They're usually not as big as some of the old ones, you know, those big bombers that just about filled a lane. They usually have higher seating positions. People like that. That's one thing about SUVs that's become very popular. They call it command seating, and it gives you the chance to look out over the road. Many of them are equipped with all-wheel drive, which has been borrowed directly from the SUV. They're just more fun to drive. They're better built. They have more modern suspension systems. They probably have more power than some of the old ones did. They're loaded with creature comforts. Some of them are, you know, just amazing blends of SUV, minivan, and old wagon. DVD systems for the back seat. You have seats that can fold flat into the floor, so you can store tremendous amounts of cargo, and yet fold them back up and have room for seven or eight.
But it sounds like marketing is expected to be a problem because people don't like the idea of the old-fashioned station wagon. So are the auto companies coming up with new names so that they can disassociate themselves from the old image?
They're desperate to call them just about anything they can, except station wagons. You have crossovers. You have urban vehicles, urban assault vehicles.
Urban assault vehicles?
We've heard that term used to describe some of them. Wagon is a word that people try to avoid, most people. I've got to tell you, the head of product development at Volvo told me the other day, I asked him, I said, wait a second, you actually have something here that you're calling a wagon. He said, well, we spent 5 years trying to find something else to call our vehicles because they're big on wagons. And he said, we couldn't find a better name, so we're just going to call it that. We're going to call it what it is.
How do you think the war on terrorism is affecting sales of SUVs right now? Because, you know, this war is being fought in an area very rich in oil, and it might affect oil prices, it might affect the availability of oil, and let's face it, the SUVs are gas guzzlers.
Yeah, you know, I've got to tell you something. I'm really surprised that this, what is really a Mideast war, has not had more of an effect directly on the auto industry related to fuel economy. A year ago, fuel economy was a big issue. It looked like we were going to have an increase in mileage standards, and it just went away. I thought when the assault on the World Trade Center and Pentagon happened, people are going to look at this and say, we could have a supply cutoff. We better start thinking about fuel economy. They didn't. In fact, when I spoke with a couple of our Michigan senators about it, they said, no, we're worried about doing anything that might hurt the domestic auto industry and the auto industry as a whole. So, in fact, fuel economy an increase in fuel economy as something the government might do seems to be off the table. And the American public has been looking at prices rather than politics.
So far,
they don't seem to care.
In fact, the Bush administration just announced it's ending its government funding for a project to develop high-mileage gasoline-fueled vehicles, and instead it's going to support a plan to develop hydrogen-based fuel cells to power cars.
Well, that's probably one of the most realistic things it could do. It had previously been a partner with the Big Three in a program called the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles, or PNGV, and that was designed to come up with passenger cars that would get something like 80 miles a gallon, about triple the average of the mid-size sedan that had once dominated American roads. Well, for one thing, those cars don't dominate anymore. SUVs do, so it was a little bit misdirected there. The automakers came up with some great technology, but by and large, it wasn't affordable, so it really wasn't going to get on the road. It was an exercise in futility because it really wasn't going to produce sellable vehicles, but some technology. So this new partnership may be the best thing it can do because that's where it appears the auto industry is about to go. And the interesting thing is there is technology on the horizon that could transform the auto industry as dramatically as anything since Benz drove his first gasoline vehicle in the 1880s.
Let's talk about some of the technology after we take a break. My guest is Paul Eisenstein. He's the publisher and editorial director of thecarconnection.com, an online magazine devoted to analyzing vehicles and the auto industry. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Eisenstein. He's the publisher and editorial director of thecarconnection.com, an online magazine about automobiles and the auto industry. He just attended the two big car shows in Los Angeles and in Detroit. Let's talk about some of the new technology in powering cars. There's a couple of directions that the auto industry has headed in here. One is the electric vehicle, the EV, where it's all electric powered, and the other is the hybrid, where it's a combination of gasoline and battery power. Where's the industry heading now? Which direction is it favoring?
Well, it's definitely not favoring the electric vehicle. Batteries are a technology nowhere near prime time, and nobody believes that they will be anytime soon. Vehicles like General Motors EV1, Honda's EV Plus, and the like were fun experiments, but they didn't work. They're too expensive, they don't have enough range, they take a long time to charge. They'll be specialty vehicles, probably limited to very special applications. And in fact, out in California, they've created a new rule which will effectively require manufacturers to sell tens of thousands of what are little more than fancy golf carts, like the Think City and Think Neighbor, which come as divisions of Ford Motor Company. Chrysler has one that it's doing as well. But battery cars, forget it. Most people are not going to put up with it. What will probably catch on is the hybrid.
And what is the hybrid? Explain how it works.
Okay. Hybrids very basically combine two different sources of power under the hood. And what they do is they use primarily a gasoline engine, pretty much the same as any automobile. But they also have the ability to recapture energy that is lost during braking or coasting. You know, whenever you apply the brakes, you're getting rid of energy. You're wasting it. So you capture that. You generate electricity back, and you pump it into a battery. Then, when it's time to start up again, or maybe when you need a little boost of power, you take the energy out of the battery, put it into some motors, and that means you can go a little faster. Maybe you can get away with a smaller engine in your car, which is the strategy that Honda has been using with its Insight. And that allows you to get significantly better mileage and, in some cases, better performance as well. Honda has one out, this teardrop two-seater called the Insight. Toyota has one out called the Prius, a very sophisticated machine, very expensive. They're selling it for far less than they can actually make it for. Honda is getting very aggressive. They are going to introduce an HEV, hybrid electric vehicle version of their best-selling Civic in just a couple months. And they expect that within a matter of a year, 10% of the sedans sold in the United States by Honda will be hybrid electrics.
Now, are these cars mostly small cars intended for use around town as opposed to for big trips?
They'll actually get the biggest fuel economy savings around town because when you're applying the brakes and then starting up again, that's where you have normally the most loss of energy. You can save the most by recapturing it. But the hybrid is going to spread into a lot of other areas as well. You're going to see a General Motors hybrid off of its big pickup platform in a couple of years. The problem is the technology doesn't always work in every application. Ford just abandoned the idea of using it on its Explorer SUV, but it is about a year away from introducing a hybrid version of its smaller Escape, which should be able to get 40 miles a gallon out of a sport utility vehicle.
Now, what's the autonomy?
Ah, that is the game changer, potentially. It's a General Motors, a motorized skateboard? It sure looks like it. I mean, it's the type of skateboard you'd expect on King Kong. I think a lot of people were surprised when they saw it roll out at the auto show the other day. It is a self-contained platform. If you were looking at it from top down, it has about the rough shape of a mid-size automobile. You look at it from the side, it looks like just the platform. There are the wheels, and there's this chassis made out of high-tech composite materials, and it's only about 6 inches thick. Obviously, it's not a full vehicle. But in that composite platform, hidden away, you find a fuel cell, hydrogen storage, 4 electric motors, and the control technology to actually make that platform move. The next step is you mount on the platform a body. It could be a sport ute body, it could be a sedan, a sports car, a pickup, it doesn't really matter. There's no mechanical connection between the controls and the vehicle. A kid who's good at video games could conceivably hook it up with that type of control system. You could have multiple bodies in your garage. You need a pickup today, you put the chassis underneath and mate it to that body. You want a sports car, you mate it to the sports car body. But the important thing is that it has been designed. This is the ultimate example of form and function, because it has been designed not around the big, bulky internal combustion engine, but around a totally game-breaking concept called the fuel cell.
So is this on the market yet?
No. The fuel cell is still a technology that's a bit beyond current use. It's got a few years of development. Out in California, they are test driving a whole fleet of fuel cell vehicles. Ford, Daimler Chrysler, Honda, and a couple other makers promised to put limited numbers of them on sale in 2004, but it'll probably be 2010 before fuel cells hit the street in high numbers. And there's an awful lot of ifs before that can happen. So that is an optimistic forecast.
Well, what is a fuel cell? How does it work?
You know, this is an interesting technology. It's a technology of the future that's been sitting on the shelf for 150 years. When they went to the moon, that was the first serious application of something that was a curiosity invented in Britain in something like the 1850s. It's surprisingly simple. In basic form, a fuel cell is a device that brings hydrogen and oxygen together, and even those who had the most basic high school chemistry know that makes water. It also creates a little current of electricity, which you can use to charge a battery, run headlights, and power an electric motor, motors that can drive the wheels of a car. The problem is, it's still very expensive, but the prices are dropping rapidly. It's still unreliable, but it's getting better. Fuel cells are big, but they're coming down in size. Everybody's watching this technology develop at an incredible rate. The bigger problems are what happens once they get to the point where they may be commercially viable. Remember, I said they run on hydrogen. And I don't know about you, but I can't gas up on that at my local gas station. I don't live close enough to NASA, so I can't go down to the place where they fuel up on hydrogen for the space shuttle. There's no infrastructure. So the next problem, they have to create an infrastructure. That means you got to convince the energy companies to do it. Let's say you get the infrastructure. Then you got to find a way to store it on your vehicle, and that's not easy. So there's a whole series of problems that they have to solve. Yet there is a general belief in the auto industry, and I do not believe it's smoke and mirrors, that this technology will be able to be put to market by the end of the decade.
And once it is, then we'll start to see the development of that skateboard on wheels that you were describing and other new car designs to suit a new form of energy.
Yeah, if you have this technology where you don't need to make a car look the way it does now, you don't have a big engine you have to put in front of the passenger compartment, mm-hmm. Why build cars the way you do now? You transform things. It could make it easier for other companies to get into the business. GM may build something like the autonomy, the skateboard, or somebody else comes up with an equally interesting concept, and maybe somebody else starts marketing bodies that you can put on your GM platform. Right now, it's nowhere near ready for market. But what it shows is a dramatic search for new technologies and new ideas in the auto industry. This is an exciting period where people are just, you know, it's a hackneyed phrase, but they're really stepping out of the box and looking for ways to do things that they have never done in the auto industry.
That's something interesting to think about. In the meantime, the new hybrid cars, what's your impression? Do you think that they're perfected enough to invest in, to buy now, or do you think people should be a little cautious and wait a couple of more years until they're improved and tested?
Well, if you're really into trying to get the best mileage possible, then hybrids are nice to get, but there aren't many of them out there. Today, you can only get two, Toyota's Prius and Honda's Insight. That little two-seater isn't going to be the car that the Insight that most people would want, so they'd probably want to wait. The same thing with the Prius. It's a nice vehicle, but it's very specialized, very small. It isn't particularly fancy for anybody who wants something a little more upmarket. Hybrids are going to start showing up in lots more numbers over the next couple of years. The Civic, the Escape, and then moving up. There won't be many choices, at least not for the next few years. And the reality is the technology is expensive. You're adding a lot of complexity to the vehicle. Nobody knows if there's going to be tax credits passed by the government. that would change the equation. But the next few years, you're probably going to see hybrids costing anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000, maybe $5,000 more than a standard vehicle. And the question that you have to ask yourself is whether your driving patterns will justify making that up through better mileage.
Paul Eisenstein is the publisher and editorial director of thecarconnection.com. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Eisenstein, publisher and editorial director of thecarconnection.com. We're talking about the latest changes in automotive design and technology. He's been to this year's auto shows in Detroit and L.A., where the industry unveils its new models. Eisenstein has covered the auto industry for 23 years. We've been talking a little bit about new ways of powering cars, fuel cells, battery power. Let's look a little bit about the exteriors of cars as they are now. One of the trends we've seen in car bodies is the retro look, particularly like the VW, the new take on the old VW Beetle, and it looks like a little toy. has that been successful, and are other car companies going in that retro direction?
It's funny. A lot of the makers hate the word retro. Designers don't like it. They like to call it heritage. You know, we're mining our past history. We're just they like to talk about DNA. This is another buzzword these days. We're going for the DNA of our brand. Ford just created a studio called the Living Legends Studio, and they showed at Detroit a concept vehicle, which I know they'd like to build, called the GT40. It's based on the vehicle, the race car, that swept the Le Mans and European circuits during the late 1960s. I mean, you look at that from a distance and you swear it's just one of the old cars brought back again. Audi's TT is a reminder of the old Carmen Ghia. The new Thunderbird, one of the hot cars of the year, has been awarded Car of the Year by several magazines. That's clearly a retro car. And in fact, the guy who leads Ford's design studio designed the retro Beetle. So there is clearly a search for old ideas, and some companies are building them unabashedly retro. Others are using little cues that they borrow to take new designs but make them feel like they have heritage. You know, you can see the connection between new cars and the old.
What about things like paint and the durability of the body? Are we making improvements in that?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. The paint is one of those things that people never really give much thought to. Remember the old days, Henry Ford said you could get in any color but black. Well, these days, it's amazing. You can get it in any color of the rainbow. And the paint is more durable. Some of these colors, some of these paint jobs are so beautiful. You feel like you go swimming in them. They're so rich and deep. But there's been dramatic changes in all sorts of little things that the customer doesn't really think about. Virtually every car now goes through all sorts of heavy corrosion protection. You're in Philadelphia, so you get some pretty hard winters. And think about it. How often do you see cars now that have serious rust on them?
I know that's really improved. My cars used to rust out like crazy, particularly when I lived in Buffalo, New York, which gets a lot of snow. And I've surely noticed the improvement in paint on the cars.
Well, you know, it's across the board. All these little things that have changed dramatically in the last 20 years. I'll tell you something which has been among the most dramatic changes we have seen in the auto industry. Nobody will ever think about. Think of it as the Rodney Dangerfield of the automobile. The tire, it never gets any respect. But the fact is, new tires have contributed more to safety, fuel economy, and performance than just about anything that has been done since the 1970s.
What has changed in tires?
Well, a couple of things. They're smarter about how to design treads. You have tires that can wick away rain so that even on slick roads, they handle almost as well as if it was dry pavement. You have these designs that can grab ice almost like suction cups. You have better compounds. The rubber is better. They've gone to radial tires over the last 30 years that last forever. You know, you used to have to change your tires. You used to have to replace them all the time. Now, some people will have tires that will last almost the life of the vehicle.
Let's talk a little bit about the interiors of the new cars. What are some of the new gizmos or new dashboards that you find particularly interesting?
Well, there's been a move towards electronics for quite a while now, but the technology seems to really be taking hold. And it's taking hold in a lot of different ways. For one thing, they're loading all sorts of gizmos that will put you in communication with the world in your car. Something called telematics, you know, onboard navigation. Satellite radio just launched for the first time. You'll actually be able to drive coast to coast and listen to the same radio station if you subscribe to one of these services and buy the special system. Video, DVD is becoming very popular. Lots of folks love this. I mean, if you're driving cross country, even you know, just 4 hours to grandma's house, having a DVD for the kids in the back seat is a great way to stop them from saying, "Are we there yet?" And they're even talking about putting internet access into the car. I'm not sure about that. And there are some issues about safety that you have to raise as we start putting all of this technology on board.
Yeah, the safety issue I think is important, because just as some people are saying, well, we shouldn't be allowed to talk on a cell phone in the car, now we're putting in DVDs and trying to get in the internet. Sure, it's swell for the people in the back seat, but I can't help but think some of the drivers are going to be taking their eyes off the road.
There was a study out of Toronto about a year or so ago that suggested that those using cell phones while driving have an accident rate equivalent to somebody who is just short of legally drunk. I hope not. I do use my cell phone when I drive occasionally. But definitely it is a distraction. New York State recently passed a law which requires that you use earpieces or hands-free phones where, you know, you don't have to take your eyes off the road. You don't have to hold something up to your ear. And more states are likely to follow. Holding a phone in your hand while driving is all but barred in most of Europe now. Now imagine people trying to deal with internet access. You know, you're checking your email. Of course, the move is to voice-activated systems. So you wouldn't actually be sitting there reading it. You'd have a system that could actually go in, check your email, read it to you in a human-like voice, and then even when you wanted to respond, translate speech to text and then send it.
I think we have a couple of years till we have that in the car.
Oh, no. We're starting to see the first of them out there right now.
Really?
As a matter of fact, Cadillac was supposed to introduce it this year, but they had a little problem with some of the technology. But there are a couple systems out there. In aftermarket, you can go and buy them at some of the big electronics stores.
You mentioned satellite radio, and this is a new service in which you'd have to subscribe. There's many different stations on the subscription service. You can get them no matter where you're driving in the United States, but you have to pay a subscription fee in order to get it, and you have to have a special new radio in the car that receives this satellite service. So some of the car companies have invested in this, and they're coming out with new cars that have this radio capability. How invested is the car industry in this new satellite radio?
Well, General Motors actually has a piece of XM satellite radio, so they're very invested, and they're going to be rolling it out in large numbers, at least they think they will, over the next year. I think they'll be watching to see how the consumer really takes hold of this technology, whether they're willing to make the investment and also spend the monthly fee. That's a big question. There's a lot of this technology out there that you're going to, in some cases, have to pay for the hardware. In some cases, manufacturers are simply putting it in the car. General Motors is a good example. They're putting in many cars the OnStar system for free, because where they think they're going to make the money is in the subscription rates. And that's another big change in the auto industry. The manufacturers are looking for ways to stay in touch with and continue to make money from the consumer after the car is driven off the dealer lot.
What is the OnStar system?
OnStar is very interesting technology. It's the biggest of what they call telematics services. Telematics means basically a blend of onboard computing and communications. At its most basic form, it is a safety and security system. You get locked out of the vehicle, you call the OnStar center, if your car is so equipped, and they can actually unlock the doors remotely by a radio signal. If you can't find your car, you can call them up and say, "Hey, flash the lights and blow the horn." They'll do that, and you can find it in a crowded parking lot. If your car is involved in an accident that sets the airbags off, it will automatically call 911 and not only alert the police that the accident has happened, but because there's an onboard satellite navigation system in there, it can lead them right to the location where the accident occurred, even if you're incapacitated.
And this is a subscription service?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. GM is offering it in many models for free, the hardware for free and a year of service for free. But then you can pay quite a bit depending on what level of service you get. I found out the other day that General Motors is the largest reseller of cellular phone minutes, airtime, in the country. And that's because of their OnStar system. They've got, 2 million subscribers right now, I think? Or they're approaching 2 million subscribers. And because they're putting it in so many cars, they expect to be adding a couple million people to that role every year.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Eisenstein. He's the publisher and editorial director of the CarConnection.com. It's an online magazine on vehicles and the auto industry. Paul, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the new cars. My guest, Paul Eisenstein, is the publisher and editorial director of thecarconnection.com. It's an online magazine that reports on vehicles and the auto industry. He just attended the big car shows in Los Angeles and Detroit. Let's look at the auto business for a second, the auto industry. Ford and General Motors are expected to be laying off thousands of workers. Why is that necessary? Why do they think it's necessary?
Well, GM probably won't lay them off. They'll continue a buyout program that they announced last year, basically encourage a lot of their redundant salaried employees to bail out. Ford has been doing the same thing. Actually, most of the many manufacturers, all of the domestics have been trying to do that this year, including Daimler Chrysler's Chrysler Group. But the big problem will be at Ford, which we can get to. But the industry has realized that it's facing serious problems. Costs, this is the most amazing thing of all. Costs have been going down an average of 1% a year for the last 5 years, even though manufacturers have been forced to add more and more content to their vehicles. Sort of like the computer industry, you get a lot more for your buck these days. And the problem is, how do you do that? What's the equation to pull that off? Well, you have to get a lot leaner than ever. You have to do more with fewer people. You have to find ways to make your assembly lines more efficient, not just in terms of fewer workers, but just doing things smarter. And that basically means that the industry is going to be employing a lot fewer people.
Ford is expected to be making a lot of changes at the end of this week. What kind of trouble has Ford been in?
What type of trouble hasn't Ford been in? This is a company that 2 years ago earned $8 billion. This year, about a week after they announced their turnaround plan, will announce their first annual loss in, decades, decade and a half, something like that. Quality went down, productivity went down, launches got delayed, and when they did, vehicles had all sorts of problems. The Escape sport utility vehicle, when it came out a little over a year ago, had 5 recalls inside of 3 months. A honed image of having the best quality of all the domestic makers has all but vanished. They had to force out their CEO a few months ago. There were two things that tripped Ford up to the point where they are now in, the disastrous situation that they're in right now. One of them was the Firestone fiasco, the recall of all those millions of tires for apparent safety defects, defects that have been linked to hundreds of deaths. And then, of course, the September 11th disaster, which threw the entire industry in a turmoil. Ford, like the rest of the makers, had to pump out some super discounts, incentives, zero interest financing, and it just broke the bottom line.
So is Ford hoping that when it announces its new strategy and its new revisions that it will get back on track?
It's going to be a long process. Even the most optimistic of Ford executive, Nick Shaler, the guy putting the turnaround plan together, admits it's probably going to take 2 years at least to bring Ford back on track. And we've seen turnaround plans take a long time. Daimler Chrysler thought that by the end of last year it would pretty much be back in shape. It has to revise its turnaround plan, so it won't be easy. Part of the problem is that the automakers are restricted from doing some of the most radical steps that they would have taken in the past. They have a contract with the United Auto Workers Union, which essentially bars in the United States any full plant closures. They can do temporary shutdowns, they can reduce the number of shifts, but they cannot shut a plant down entirely. And that limits their options significantly. So Mr. Shaler has said that this is going to be just phase one of their turnaround plan.
After September 11th, the auto industry was so worried that sales would plummet that it introduced a lot of incentives to buyers, particularly like 0% financing. Mm-hmm. Can we expect those things, those discounts and financing plans to stay in place for 2002?
Well, we have seen that the zero interest loan programs are essentially at their end. General Motors wrapped up its program, which they called Keep America Rolling, about a week ago. Ford will shortly end its program, as has Daimler Chrysler. But GM replaced it with a program that essentially gives you $2,002 back on 2001 and 2002 models. That's a big, big discount. And that type of program is likely to continue for a while. The industry is facing a problem because the incentives work too well. They sold so many cars that they drew a lot of buyers that might have been in the market in 2002 into the last months of 2001. So now they've got to find a way to bring people back in the market. It's one of these self-fulfilling negative prophecies. You know, you spend money, you do well, and you hurt yourself for the future. And people are worried that this could be a disastrous year for car sales. But then again, for the consumers who can afford it, it could be a great year for the buyer.
Leave us with some consumer advice. Do you think this is a good time to buy a new car? And is there anything that you recommend that we think about if we are looking for one as we enter this new kind of car market? New in terms of the product and in terms of the financing and the deals.
It is a great time to buy. According to the affordability index, auto affordability index that Comerica Bank does, cars are now at their lowest price, adjusted for inflation, since any time since 1980. So that's one good sign. Incentives will be good. And here's the most important thing. The consumer has access to more knowledge than ever before. This is self-interest. I am a publisher of a website. There's a lot of them out there. And there's tons of information on the internet and in print. So consumers go in armed for bear. They know more about the product than the typical salesperson. They know about the pricing. They know what the dealer is paying to get it from the factory. It changes the equation in who has power doing the deal. So that's one good sign why it's a good year. But people need to be well prepared. Do their homework. Go out there. Find out the type of vehicles that are available. Find out what you're going to pay for it. Get a sense of what the competition is. And if you do, you're going to be in control of the bargaining process when you go to the dealership.
Paul Eisenstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure to be with you.
Paul Eisenstein is the publisher and editorial director of theCarConnection.com. This is Fresh Air.